So I'm going to talk about 20 minutes and start a big argument, and then we'll have the argument. That is my goal. So security and usability, while we have neither, is, I think, because we're not really good at enabling system trust for users. And I think a huge part of that is because of the way we think of users, that there's only one other industry that calls its customers users, and users are used by and owned by their technology, and the language we use matters. So if we think about them as participants with whom we are engaging in a trust decision, we might get a little more effective designs. If we think of them as people instead of algorithmic users. So I'm going to make an argument from two perspectives, the trust perspective and the risk perspective. I do not think, despite the title, it's not really usable security, right? And it's not about default security. Obviously, everything that can be made secure by default should be made secure by default. But the computer can provide an individual information that it has about distance and connection and what the connection really is to assist them in making a decision, but the computer can't know if the CFO is on the phone yelling in your ear saying, send me the PowerPoint deck now or you're fired. So there's things that we cannot know that we have to just help and engage with people in making these trust decisions. So it's not usability because people rarely want to perform security tasks. I realize that this is, you know, maybe not true in this audience, but we're a very small audience. I mean, you saw, I just got that incredibly important patch update, right? I didn't sit down and say, oh, I totally want to update my OS now and fix those. I wanted to get this presentation, right? I don't want to do security tasks like it's like the dishes. And people, again, you saw it, I subverted, minimized, and endeavored to ignore my own security alerts. And we need to trust our machines. We need to trust our machines because we've got to interact. And one of the things about risk is that this is not a scary machine. It is not scary. They are just not scary. We are never going to scare. We will never be frightened of our machines. It's like trying to tell me to be frightened of my big, friendly puppy dog, you know? There are things in the world that are scary that we are kind of hardwired to find scary. A Mac Air is not going to be one of those. So what we want to do traditionally in usable design is you make the connection between action and consequence clear. You turn your phone on, you push the button. Well, you know, that's a problem in security, right? Well, if you push this button 7 times, one time, your phone will blow up in your hand. It will become a listening device for, I don't know, I would say the NSA, but I guess that's kind of redundant, right? They have it anyway. So uncertainty is very hard to make security usable in the traditional usable way because who knows what the consequence is? Is there a consequence? Maybe there's no consequence. This is a traditional problem in all kind of risk and trust decisions. In fact, one of the classic social definitions of trust is that you are not really trusting someone if there is not a consequence, if they fail. So, you know, right now I am trusting you if I say, oh, I really need you to tell Greg Whitten when he's here tomorrow, blah, right? But if I tell you and you and you and you that, then I don't actually trust any of you because I'll be in good shape if one of you fails. So, and it's also true that consequences are catastrophic. Did everybody read about the escrow company that is out of business, that in 24 hours went from a business sustaining people's livelihoods to under a bankruptcy judge because their bank stopped using the second factor random number generators and just went with a password? Well, they were wiped out. They're an escrow company. That's their lives and their livelihoods. Another problem is that there can be too much information. What is the action risk consequence information about speeding? You know, automobiles are pretty complicated, but the action risk consequence information about speeding is actually fairly clear. And even though it's probabilistic, there's some uncertainty that's kind of, you know, a nice linear uncertainty that's worse if you're going 90 than if you're going 60, and it's worse if it's raining and it's nighttime, that you can imagine these probabilities. These are a little harder. And if we try to get people to communicate, we get situations where they're overwhelmed. Many people advocate for user education. And I would say, as a community, we have done a great job of decades of user education. People know when that pop-up shows up, you need to get it the hell out of the way as fast as possible. This is, you know, I mean, these things are as popular as Clippy. And yeah, we've learned. We know how to interact with security now. And then when you have a decision to make, where's the information? I saw this free public Wi-Fi when I was at National Airport. Right? Nobody here is going to connect to this great free public Wi-Fi at National Airport. There was like a tornado. The Wi-Fi was completely slammed. You know, I got rerouted the next evening through Dulles is how I got home. And there are all these people with, you know, critical businesses and security clearances and those horrible phones they make you carry when you work for the government. And where's the RiskNet information, right? This just says, oh, there's a device that is free public Wi-Fi. Who doesn't want that? That's like free beer. There's no risk information there. The other thing you can do is security as a default and ask for explicit confirmation, but that may be disabling. There was another study that was at SOUPS that said something like 60% of people want to disable, that 60% of people that use antivirus scans want to disable them, they can't figure out how. So I think it's good that this part of the population can't figure out how, but that they want to disable it might not be great. So this is what you get if you have your, say, your mail up and you want to connect through the airport. This is the warning I would have gotten if I had connected to any of those Wi-Fis, including the device Wi-Fi. And because it pops up every time, you know, you learn to ignore it. And if you ask for more information, it gives you more information. Wow, this is great. If you run this through one of those things that says grade average, you have to have 2 years of college to understand this on average. That cuts out the most vulnerable parts of our population. When you connect to a secure website, the server hosting the site presents your browser with something called a certificate to verify its identity. Who cares? Really? Really? When you smoke this cigarette, you're inhaling something called a carcinogen. Is that what the package says? No, it says smoking's going to kill you. And this is like, people are going to steal your money. It doesn't say that anywhere. Oh, and contact your organization's help staff for assistance in adding a new root certificate to your computer. The first time I got this, I was in an airport in Europe. Now, obviously, I can add a root certificate, but can you imagine if you're, you know, if this is your company and your job is to sell widgets or to do presentations for, you know, on something other than security? So security, it's never going to be scary. And it may be unpleasant. And in fact, I know a group of people that are advocating for increasingly unpleasant information for security, so it makes it harder to ignore. And can I just say, in a word, no. No. If you want to make people your partners, you don't torment them. I mean, maybe I'm doing it wrong, but in general, I think, you know, that's how it works. So you can show risk avoidance. And this is really critical with old people. I know not, you know, security for old people is not like the hottest topic at this conference, but they have all the money. They do, and they are more susceptible to fraud than any other population. And if you work, I work with old people. I have a, you know, attached at the hip, dear friend gerontologist who keeps me from getting them too upset, because they are really easy to get them upset. And if you're upset, you're even more vulnerable to fraud. So if you make it unpleasant, you're actually hurting them. So what you want to be is timely, careful, targeted, and personalized. If you go to Facebook, you get really personalized ads. How long do I have? How am I doing? Okay. But you get the same stupid security warning, right? I mean, sure, Facebook gets it wrong every time. One of my grad students has a kid, Facebook thinks I'm pregnant. Do you know how irritating that is? But at least they're trying. We have all this information about you on your machine, and we don't use it. So the thing I go for is not opaque. Don't think about opaque. Don't think about usable. Think about translucent, right? You want to see through it, but not too much. You know, it's like the fuzzy thing in your bathroom window. You want the light to come in, but you don't really want the details. So people understand the context. They understand what they're trying to do and why they're trying to do it. We understand the risk. And if you can just communicate the risk, then people can make better decisions. Now, having said that, I'm going to totally disagree with myself, so you're definitely going to get an argument with me. But individuals don't engage in the calculus of risk, online or off, right? So one of the ways you do risk communication offline is there are 9 dimensions that are kind of the canonical dimensions of risk, right? Slovak came up with these 9 dimensions. They explain about 20% of people's risk responses, okay? Which is pretty good. And the other thing that matters to people, and this is something that I'm endeavoring to embed in the risk communication that we're demoing, sadly, next month, it's not ready now, is moral motivation. People will forgive huge technical incompetence, but they will forgive very little, be forgiving of very little moral failures, right? So we showed people 2 things. We showed a change in privacy notification. We had this experiment and it said, this is a web management site and it will remind you of all your nieces and nephews and first cousins and business partners and second cousins once removed, birthdays and what you bought for them last year, and make some suggestions, right? Here's a nice, you will never forget to send roses again. You'll be a great, friendly, beloved auntie. And a change in the privacy policy, and we showed them another person's data, everything. I mean, it was made up. John Q. Wilson, if anybody remembers all the John Wilsons at IBM, people responded much more strongly to the first. They felt like, oh, you know, this is evil. And if we can communicate some of the malevolence that is happening on the network, you know, you are a good person and you rinse out your cat food can every day and recycle it because you don't litter and recycling is important. Why are you helping organized crime launder money? And if you can communicate some things in moral terms, people will be much more responsive to the actions you're asking them to take. And I think we should not be afraid of doing that, of saying, this risk you're taking can impinge others, which is all that means. So we showed a change in privacy policy, and another person's like the details of the guy's life, his credit card number, his social security number, his sweetheart, he was his sweetheart's birthday and that she likes purple roses, it was all up there, no secrets. But we found out that people responded much more strongly to this minor moral change. So if we can embed some of what we know and expect people to use their heuristics and their social behaviors online, we really can make a difference, right? So one of the things we did is we asked people to estimate virtual risk. And one of the problems in estimating virtual risk in working with a population is, so if you ask people, are you a security expert? Most master students will say, like, I don't know, maybe. But the freshmen, oh my God, are they security experts, right? I mean, they can spell RSA in their sleep. So we added some fake ones. We had vampires and the 614 shuffle to determine if people who are claiming expertise were also familiar with these known risks. I do want to see a computer become a vampire. And then we judged against the 9 classic dimensions of risk, and I'm going to give you those dimensions, and then we're going to talk about computer risk, okay? So that you get to talk soon. Stay awake. One is it voluntary? Do you get to decide to be exposed? Are you breathing pollution, or are you breathing your own personal selected brand of smoke, right? If it's voluntary, it's more acceptable. It's more acceptable for people to die jumping out of an airplane for fun than in a coal mine, right? Is it immediate? So, you know, I believe this guy was hit by a car right after this, because he's in the middle of traffic and he went back for his flip-flop. However, global warming is not necessarily immediate, so it's just less scary. Do you know about it? If it's familiar, it's just, you know, it's just not as frightening. If you're, those aren't really genetically modified, but it's such a cool picture. I can resist. They're grown in boxes. But you know, a hot stove is familiar if you're handed some, you know, thing like the Green Lantern got that was all glowing. You're going to be a little more afraid of it. Knowledge of risk to science, to what extent are the risks associated known to experts? And so this depends on trust in expertise. This can cut either way. People can be like, oh, those scientists are experimenting on us again. Google does it, you know. Or they can be more confident and feel more safe. And this is one of the things that is kind of ideologically grounded. So when you think about risk communication, you can actually maybe personalize the communication based on the other person's activities. Once you are exposed to the risk, okay? Once you are exposed to the risk, can you control the outcome? This is different from voluntariness. Voluntariness is whether you're exposed. This is once exposed, I've decided to leave the house and come to Washington, D.C., all right? That was voluntary. Once I did that, did I decide to fly in an airplane, or did I decide to drive a car? So no, this doesn't apply to anybody that flew their own airplane, but picky. Is it new and different, right? So one of these is a beautiful Catawba nuclear station, and one of these is a coal plant. One of them is very, very, very scary. The other one increases your likelihood of cancer if you live near it. These are not the same ones, right? Is it something that is, and this is where computer security really lacks. I mean, the shark, this is rare. How many of us are at risk for snake or shark bite right now? Ooh, how many of us are at risk of the flu right now? Right? Are you breathing? But the snakes are scarier because if it's common, you can't live your life in fear of it. And yes, I do think that was the best Star Trek, and we can discuss that later. Did a bunch of people die, or did one person die? The 16-car pileup is more frightening than 8 2-car wrecks. And the more catastrophic it is, the more frightening it is, which is why you get something like, you know, the flu is not scary, but the pandemic was scary, the bird flu was scary, the pork flu. flu, whatever the last one was. And the biggest one is severity, right? She might cut her hand, but he's about to have a very, very bad day. So we did all these tests, and we said, well, what is computers? Well, it's not immediate. It's kind of chronic, so it's less scary. It's never going to be dreadful. And it's perceived as totally understood by experts. You'll be happy to know that in the common parlance, we have it all down. You can just go home. You don't need to do any more research. But severity was huge, whether or not it was voluntary, and whether or not it's controllable. So we know some variables that we can use about this. And we can make risk appear immediate with timely warnings at the decision and controllable with mitigation. So if you look at folk practices, these are folk practices that have been described in the literature from Paul and Carlton, whose name I'm spacing on, and Rick Wash in Michigan. So if you believe that there are eavesdroppers out there, then you can turn your screen a little. See, now you're safe. Now the NSA can't read your email. He can, though. Sorry. If they only go after big fish, you do nothing. Now, what's funny about this is if you talk to the guy who's in charge of, there's a guy who handles, like, home security for Goldman's top clients. They do not consider themselves big fish, because they're only worth hundreds of millions of dollars. They're not billionaires like the big fish. I know. If you consider it just bad kids running around, people will back up. Nobody patches. There is no common model that says, I should patch my machine. There is no threat model that indicates my machine should be patched. And that's a problem we have. Firewalls are just too weird. Like phishing? Phishing is the stupidest word in the history of stupid words. I mean, it communicates nothing. Why do you want to tell people this is phishing, learn this word that's based on a joke from like the 70s with phone boxes? That is not risk communication. And firewalls, similarly, people are like, firewalls? I don't need a firewall. What is, like the SWAT team at my door? You can get people to update antivirus. What have we taught? Be careful what websites you visit. Everybody knows not to visit bad websites. How bad is defined is not certain, and it varies. I mean, some people think, well, porn is bad, right? But some people think, like, the other guy's political website is bad. There are people who are like, oh, that Al-Qaeda news, that's terrorist. And they don't patch. But that doesn't really matter, because if machines are repaired quickly, because we'll never get 100% patching, the real critical variable is repairing machines. So how do you tell the difference between these two banks? Which is the phishing site? Yeah, we all got it. The one with the crappier name is, and the SSL lock is the real bank. The one with the better name and no lock. So compare this to these places. Here are places. Look at the amount of information available to distinguish here. Look at the amount of information to distinguish here. You have everything. You have sight, sound. You have smell, speed. Whether or not other people are there and location are things that your computer knows and can tell you. But one of the things that we're working on in our lab is basically to figure out what smells funny on the internet. How do you detect that? In the Hong Kong ladies jewelry market? Yes, because you're connecting to a large number of unknown vendors. It depends on the history of the vendor. I think it would have to be a per booth. If you started to enter your bank password here, yes. And how does the browser know to show you a phishing warning? Because the fake page has been visited, which means We do have a lot of in-browser heuristics that we're working on, but it's still the way we do this is mostly, most people experience this through Blacklist. And if you look at like Rockfish, they may give you like, they're cycling so fast, there may be 6 or 8. I agree that in-browser heuristics are a way to get past this and to show people that there's something you can do that's voluntary. But I will also say, mostly they will just go through the warning because that's what we've been teaching them to do for 20 years. So only 20%, after you've explicitly told them this is a phishing site, are still determined to get to the phishing site. Do you see if they enter their credentials? Okay, do you tell them to call your bank? No. What do we tell them? We tell them this thing up here that says, wait, here it is. This is what we tell them. Great. Well, I have the Google warning for phishing site, and it tells you what phishing is. I don't care. It's a stupid warning to tell people what phishing is. Like, nobody cares. Call your bank. A lot of people do ask, and if I'm not relying just on the SSL lock icon, I'm telling you every website I visit. So it's true that I can choose to engage with you such that you get absolute surveillance of my browsing, and in exchange, you will then give me warnings. But if I do not choose to engage in that deal with you, I get the lock. I mean, I realize most people don't care about privacy, but a lot of people do care about privacy, and older people in particular care about privacy. They don't know how to instrument that. They don't. If you ask them about their data footprints, they don't understand it. But if they know that there's this privacy deal, they'll do it. But okay, there. Thanks. But we're at questions now, so let's go there. So yeah, I have to say, I think all our warnings are an atrocity. I would like to see computer scientists build cancer warnings for cigarettes. Print would be really tiny.
No, usage instructions. No one will ever smoke again.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to put Microsoft in charge of usage instruction for cigarettes, and that will resolve the issue. I think generally risk communication is about telling people how to mitigate. It's not about telling people what the risks are. It's about outcome, but not the mechanics of the risk. And I just want to, and then when we do tell people what the risks are, we make very explicit deals with them. If you let me observe everything, I will warn you that this is a phishing site. I don't think we respect the people that use our products. And if we do respect it, it's not embedded in our communication to them. It is my personal belief that is not well-founded, that most certificate warnings are actually and are actually liability warnings. They're shifting the liability towards the user instead of helping them not to engage with risky behavior. So I was just mean to everybody in the room, and nobody's going to yell at me but her. Come on. So, I think, how do you manage risk in a good way? I think that Silent Circle is doing a good job. I think that Silent Circle has made encryption genuinely usable without much communication about what it's doing. And so Silent Circle is, you guys know what that is? Okay, so Silent Circle is an application that provides, you haven't? Okay. So you want to tell people what it is then?
It's encrypted email, but it is it's a service that provides encrypted text messaging and encrypted VoIP phone call.
So how do you know you're communicating to the right person when you start a phone call on Silent Circle? Oh, okay. All right, so if you start a phone call to tell you that you're not having a silent circle, that you're not experiencing man in the middle, there's a little message that is a word, and it says, read this word to the person at the other end of the phone call, and that word should be appearing at their phone call. They don't say, you know, this is a man in the middle attack, there's such a thing as a certificate. They say, read this word. Cool. I can do that.
Bite on your last comment, trashing us all quietly. I don't even think it's on. Loud enough, all right, there we go. Okay. I would say that it's not so much that we don't respect the users, it's just that when people are creating the warnings, you know, there's a reason why we teach English for engineers in university. And it's a matter of context, right? If you've got somebody who's developing a feature, and they're, if you take the browser example, and what they're doing is they're implementing the, you know, the SSL certificate checking within the browser. They are usually so deep in that, and they have little to no usability training, that it's just not in their context to put themselves into the user's head. So I don't think it's malicious as much as unintended ignorance from the fact that they go, yeah, everybody knows about, you know, certificate trust chains. And, you know, so we had this discussion a little earlier with, even as a professional or an expert in that, can you easily validate that that certificate is valid within a browser, right? You have to go through layers of dialogues, you have to verify different fingerprints. It's an arduous task, right? It's not well thought out from a user's perspective. It may be well thought out from a technical implementation, though it's not really, but you know, that's another discussion. From a usability perspective, though, it's not like they sit back and go, okay, how is my mom approaching this? And that's something, you know, we need to do, but that's a long-term, like, how many actual well-trained usability professionals are also building security stuff or are working at security companies? It's a bigger problem than that, but I would say it's not malicious as much as unintended ignorance.
Okay. It's not a topic that people necessarily engage in, so I'd just like to say that of everybody I know in all of computer security, I think there are, like, three malicious people. And no, I won't tell you who they are.
Well, I'll say something malicious. No, not really, but for the silent circle, it may be easy to do. Has there been a study to see if people actually detect if they are being man in the middle, if the other side says, oh, don't worry about the word, or you read the word that's on your screen, and then they say, ah, that's the same as mine. I mean, I guess I haven't seen it studied in the failure mode, so I don't have any reason to believe it actually is secure.
No, that's a great study. I should totally do that. You're right. Sorry, that was probably too.
That's not how we do an argument, Gene. You have to.
let me see. I'm sorry, I agree with you. I can't. But yes, I think that social engineering on Silent Circle would be a very fun study to do, and I will ask them for licenses so I can do that, because I think that the, you know, right now I believe it says read the word, and it doesn't say if you're not sure, make them read the word. There is a problem though with usability, because how does everybody in the world make phone calls like this, right? Like, that's not my phone. You go like this. In Silent Circle, you want to make a phone call, you have to do this. But they'll probably fix that. That's kind of minor.
So this is really interesting, because it sounds almost more like a business proposal than a debate, because there's old people with money and they don't have a browser that fits their needs.
So when you do a startup for an old people browser, I should totally be on your board.
All right.
But I love being a professor.
Game on.
I do, so I'm going to be a professor. I think it's a great.
Assume the other microphone.
Where's the other microphone?
Oh, really? Oh, okay. I don't really need a microphone, but I have the baton. I've been handed the baton.
Overcome your natural shyness.
I had a number of comments, but Silent Circle using a word, I mean, Provost demonstrated 15 years ago, vomit. You can insert a piece of somebody else's voice in the middle of any phone conversation with anyway. So that's, that's very nebulous security. On your risks, the embarrassment factor you didn't have in there, or maybe you tried to have that with showing them examples of all the things, the public knowledge that people have about you. I can tell you something from the voting side of the world that I actually have practical experience with. If you send postcards, this is not my idea, but I did participate in the study, postcards out to every voter in a precinct or whatever, explaining how many times they've gotten to the election and how many times their neighbors have. And on the postcard, there were three tests. The strongest was, and we're going to send your voting record out to all of your neighbors after the election. Increased turnout by 9%.
Wow.
In fact, that was our strongest result. I mean, merely telling them that you knew gave you a couple percent, whatever. If you told them, and by golly, if you don't vote, we're going to tell all of your neighbors, that really improved a great deal. So I think that your example there of saying, yes, this is the kind of personal information that's been being collected about you, maybe having said, and we're going, if you do this, we're going to tell people this about you, would give a stronger reaction. It certainly works in the voting arena.
Well, I have some, wait a second. Ooh, yeah, I have a lot of pictures. Way down here somewhere, I have some examples of effective, one of the things. I go to YouTube and I'll watch public service announcements. So sue me. So I'd say litter is one of the most effective ones that I've seen. And drunk driving has been completely socially changed, right? I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was 15 and had my permit, it was a non-issue. Maybe it's a Southern thing, but now it's a horrible thing to do. And then there's the, this is what happens. And I gotta say, I don't have a drunk driving one on this page because all of the drunk driving ones are too horrible to put on a page. They make the shark look like Winnie the Pooh. So we know what has worked. We also know what has failed. So the great case study of how not to do risk communication is from the nuclear industry. All the things that they went through as they did risk communication pretty much increased fear of nuclear power. So the first thing they did is they listed all the terrible things they could do to you. And then they listed the probabilities. And then they tried to convince those were terrible because people were like, oh, I'm gonna get a third eye. And they were just, they're terrified of it. All the actions that the scientists took made people feel less powerful and more afraid. And if you compare that with changing risk behaviors like speeding or smoking, people do not feel less powerful. They feel like this is something I can control. And to the extent that we can really communicate, this is something you can control, this is how you can control it. Oh.